I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. And my guest today is writer, historian, and Iowan, Maureen Ogle. Maureen is the author of several books, including the book Ambitious Brew, The Story of American Beer. That's from 2006. For her latest book, she spent 7 years going through over 200 years of government documents, trade magazines, newspapers, personal accounts. It's called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And in it, she tells the story of the battle surrounding meat and livestock production in American history, going way back to the colonial era. And she gives historical perspective on many of the debates that we hear in our news about the role of meat in a healthy diet, for instance, or meat packing processes. Publishers Weekly calls Ogle's bipartisan approach a breath of fresh air. Maureen Ogle joins us in our AIM studio for the entire hour. Hello, Maureen.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate having you on this. This is such a fascinating book. I can't tell you the number of things that I learned about things that are often on my dinner table that I didn't know before. Maureen, I wonder if I could ask you to read the first couple of paragraphs in your book. They set the scene so nicely about what you intend to do here. Can I ask you to do that?
Sure. Of course. Truly, we may be called a carnivorous people, wrote an anonymous American in 1841, a statement that is as accurate today as it was then. But to that general claim, a 21st century observer would likely add a host of caveats and modifiers. Although we Americans eat more meat than almost anyone else in the world, our meat-centric diets are killing us, or not, depending on whose opinion is consulted. Livestock production is bad for the environment, or not. The nation's slaughterhouses churn out tainted meat and contribute to outbreaks of bacteria-related illnesses, or not. The only thing commentators might agree on is this. In the early 21st century, battles over the production and consumption of meat are nearly as ferocious as those over, say, gun control and gay marriage. Why is that? Why do food activists want to ban the use of antibiotics, gestation stalls, and confinement in livestock production? Why have livestock producers, whether chicken growers, hog farmers, or cattle ranchers, turn to social media, blogs, and public relations campaigns to defend not just meat, but their role in putting it on the nation's tables? This book answers those questions and more by looking at the history of meat in America.
Maureen Ogle reading from her latest book, In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. So your goals here are to look at each side of what we say we have sides of the debate in this meat debate when you compare it to gay marriage and gun control. Or what was your goal here?
That actually wasn't my goal. Although, you know, inadvertently, I discovered that I was in the middle of this debate, whether I wanted to be or not. Frankly, I set out to write this book because my brain told me it was a good idea for a book, and I just let my brain do the heavy lifting when it comes up with book topics. In 2006, I had just finished the beer book, which you mentioned earlier, and I was hunting about for a new topic, and through a weird series of events, my brain said, write this book. And I will be honest, despite having lived in Iowa my entire life, I knew absolutely nothing about meat. I only started eating meat about, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago. I did not know anything about these ferocious debates at all. And weirdly, to sort of add the weirdness quotient to the max here, the same week that my beer book came out in 2006, Michael Pollan's book Omnivore's Dilemma came out. And I didn't really pay any attention to it because I was busy promoting the beer book. But of course, as I investigated the history of meat in America, I became keenly aware that his book and this ongoing food debate were big topics, really big topics. So I did not set out to address any of these issues. Okay. The book just sort of took over.
Right. I really want to get to have you tell the history part of this, going back to the colonial era. But since you mentioned it, maybe you could comment on that your book is in more modern times seen as a counterpoint to books like Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser, and Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan. Can you sum up where you disagree with those?
Well, I have disagreements and agreements with both sides, and there are definitely sides. frankly, I'm not really on either side, and I don't have any skin in this game. I'm just a historian who inadvertently wrote a book about what I didn't realize how controversial it was when I started. So my hope for the book is that people who think they're on a side or who think they understand everything there is to understand about our very complicated food system will read this book and realize it's not nearly as simple as a lot of people make it sound. You know, the Polonesque view is unfortunately a little simplistic, in my opinion. That's my main critique of it.
We'll get back to that, I think, later in the hour.
Okay.
Let's talk about the early period, because this is very interesting. You write about how eating meat set us apart from the rest of the world in the colonial period. How much meat were European immigrants used to eating?
Virtually none. When and again, I sure as heck didn't know this. When in the old world, in Europe and England in the 17th century, the overwhelming majority of people rarely ate meat, probably at harvest time, but that was about it. Meat consumption that was tracked, and we have very few firm statistics, was primarily on the part of powerful nobility and, you know, people who had a lot. But when settlers came to North America, the great culture shock, the great psychological shock to them was that there was plenty of everything here, particularly land, which had always been the drawback in the old world. You know, the reason people didn't eat meat was because they couldn't keep livestock because they didn't have enough land. And in the New World, that wasn't true. And literally from about day one, the settlers here realized that they could keep livestock with no trouble at all, and that there was appeared to be an infinite amount of land. And very quickly, they developed what I call a sense of entitlement about meat. And visitors who came over to visit the colonies were constantly flabbergasted at how often people ate meat every day, more than once a day. It was remarkable.
And so this really became very early on a part of the American identity.
Yes. In the early part of the book, in the first chapter, I argue that this sense of entitlement, if you really want to understand the meat system we have today, in the 21st century, you need to understand this centuries-long sense of entitlement on the part of Americans. We are the people who have lots and lots of food, and we are the people who eat meat whenever we want to.
Mm. Tell us about some of the major innovators and the innovations in our meat history. What jumps out at you as something you'd like to tell us about in the history of it? Because, when we start out, we have what? We have farmers with their cattle, and then we have cattle going into being led into big cities to slaughterhouses.
Right. And again, since I didn't know anything, everything was a surprise. But here's something that really did surprise me completely. Until the early 1880s, meat processing, livestock slaughter and meat processing were completely urban. These days, of course, I'm sure everyone in Iowa and around the country realizes that meat processing is a rural business. It's not, we don't have slaughterhouses in cities. But until the 1880s, that's where animals were taken. They were driven across land and then later by railroad to cities for slaughter. So the entire business of trading livestock and then slaughtering it and then hauling, you know, carcasses to butcher shops, and even butchers slaughtered their own animals, was all urban-based. And it was, as you might imagine, if you stop for a minute and ponder the consequences or the implications of that, it was it made for an interesting urban experience. But in the early 1880s, a small group of entrepreneurs, and they were very, very small group, only a handful of men, decided that the more logical thing and the more efficient, profitable way to do it was to slaughter livestock closer to where the animals were raised, specifically in Chicago, St. Louis, and Kansas City. And then instead of shipping those live animals clear across the country, shipping live meat. And in the space, I'm sorry, fresh meat. And in the space of literally about 7 or 8 years, this handful of entrepreneurs completely overturned these centuries of tradition of this urban-based business. I was astounded that such a big industry could be changed so quickly.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting in that when you're having that discussion in the book, that when the livestock was first shipped longer distances for slaughter, it was interesting. There were worries about how those days of transit would affect the taste of the beef, or whether it would be harmful to eat after those animals had been, I guess, stressed out by travel?
Yes, there were a couple of things that drove this transformation. It wasn't that Gus Swift and Phil Armour were just such geniuses that they could overturn it. It was clear that the moment had come. Americans who were living in cities frankly, we're tired of having cattle wandering through the streets and hogs, you know, racing down alleyways and running into shops and businesses, and who can blame them? So there was a strong public support for the transformation of this. And one of the other features of that particular moment was that a guy named Henry Berg, a New Yorker, he's the man who founded the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in the U.S., he launched a campaign to eliminate hauling livestock over 1,000 miles or more by rail, arguing that it was bad for the animals, that the animals would arrive, as he said, diseased and feverish, and then people were eating bad meat. So there were a combination of factors that came together at that particular moment, but one of them was definitely the idea that transporting livestock resulted in meat that was bad to eat.
Mm-hmm. And also, you point out in the book, pure economics. An animal that's transported that far loses poundage, so you have less poundage to to market. Another surprise in your book is a myth exploded, if I can put it that way. You write about Upton Sinclair's classic from 1906, The Jungle, and we commonly think of this as a huge spur for change in the meat industry. You say it ain't so.
No, it's not. I don't set out to bust myths, but in this case, whenever someone says, for example, just to use an analogous situation, the claim about Gus Swift is that he invented the refrigerator car. He did not invent the refrigerator car. He just happened to use a refrigerator cars. In the case of Upton Sinclair, who I found to be just a thoroughly unlikable human being.
Unlikable?
Unlikable, yes.
Right?
Upton Sinclair was... had a well-developed sense of entitlement himself. He really wanted to be rich and famous, and he latched on to socialism as the thing that was going to make him rich and famous, and please insert the jokes about the irony of the situation. It's just fine. And he went to Chicago to investigate the stockyards there, and having been inspired by some other writers who had already done the same, and he thought that this book that he wrote about it would make him, again, rich and famous. He wanted it to be a bestseller, and the book really was doomed to go nowhere, but at the same time, Americans were clamoring for food reform, not necessarily meat reform, but they were, a national food system had become very well shaped at that point, and Americans were starting to wonder about what it meant to eat food that was not local. So Teddy Roosevelt, who was president at the time, realized that the voters were speaking and he'd better get on the subject of food safety, but he was having a hard time convincing Congress to go along with it. Congress had been debating food safety at that point, federal legislation for food safety, for 50 years at that point, and had never passed it for constitutional reasons, not because of, you know, big lobbyists or anything. And Teddy Roosevelt realized that Upton Sinclair's book might help him push Congress into passing this legislation that he wanted. It was actually kind of a comical story, but yeah, I wouldn't credit Upton Sinclair with much of anything except looking out for his own skin.
let's delve a little bit more into the health aspects of it, because of course, when we talk about meat these days, we talk about health. You know, what types of meat are best for us? But how have the health benefits of eating meat been viewed throughout our 200-plus year history?
Well, again, very surprising to me. In the 19th century, scientists understood very little about what we think of as the science of nutrition. That they knew that there was fat and protein, but that's about as far as they'd gotten. There was almost no concept of the notion of calorie. Vitamins had not been discovered yet, believe it or not. And meat was regarded as the most beneficial food you could eat because it's so rich in protein. And when in the 1880s the federal government finally adopted kind of an official agency to improve the nation's nutrition, and yes, it goes back that far to the 1880s, the person in charge of it, Wilbur Atwater, encouraged everybody to eat lots and lots and lots of meat. But in the early 20th century, when a Polish scientist discovered vitamins, that really changed. All of a sudden, people were being urged to eat vegetables, eat vegetables, eat vegetables. And for the first time, meat had a challenger to its supremacy in the nation's diet. And meat, of course, had never went away, but vegetable, you can actually track the uptick in American consumption of fruits and vegetables from the time that vitamins were discovered in the early 20th century. And then again, in the 1970s, Senator George McGovern chaired an investigative committee which concluded that, man, meat was really the worst thing you could possibly eat, and beef consumption fell off a cliff then and has never recovered. So ideas about our diet have gone up and down, back and forth, but Americans still want meat. We still eat more meat than anybody else in the world.
What about when it comes to eating certain types of meat, when we pit one meat against the other, beef versus pork, pork versus chicken?
Right. That is something that became one of the most fascinating issues that I found when I was writing this book, that McGovern committee in the Senate that I mentioned in the 1970s. That is the moment when he said meats. The committee concluded, a very Ralph Nader-influenced committee, I might add. Ralph Nader turned out to be a weirdly central figure in the second half of the book. The McGovern report concluded that meat was bad for your diet, and instead you should either eat chicken or you should eat fish. And that is the moment when chicken consumption in the United States began to accelerate. There was a small uptick in poultry consumption after World War II. So poultry consumption was on the way up, but with the issuing of that report in the late 1970s, chicken production started climbing, and it is Americans' favorite meat. So what Americans do when there are health issues, they trade off. They don't stop eating one meat. They tend to trade off, and the trade-off for the last 40 years or so has been chicken rather than pork or beef.
Mm-hmm. River to River listeners, Maureen Ogle is my guest this hour. Her new book is titled In Meat We Trust, giving some historical context to meat industry, meat consumption news that we consume here on public radio have for the last few years. What are your questions about our country's meat production, consumption, and our carnivorous culture? Perhaps you want to take issue with something or delve further into something that Maureen has mentioned this hour. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Now, we know these days food activists are working to ban the use of antibiotics, gestation stalls, confinement in livestock production. I wonder how much of the treatment of animals has been a concern throughout American history. Have we before been this concerned about the animal, separated from the fact of, well, if we treat it that way, it will taste different or it won't be as heavy as we would like it to be when we sell it?
That's an interesting question. And so I'll just give you a sort of a very, very brief rundown. During the colonial period, one thing that all of those visitors from abroad commented on was how cruelly Americans treated their animals. And that was because Americans had so much land, they just let the animals roam around. They didn't want to waste time building fences and so forth. So Americans got a reputation for being heartless when it came to their livestock. They didn't build barns. They didn't try to pen their animals.
They had to sit out all winter, didn't
they? Yeah, which obviously isn't going to hurt an animal. But Europeans were actually shocked by that. And by the middle of the 19th century, by the middle of the 1800s, Americans really had a terrible reputation. Henry Berg's campaign, the man I mentioned earlier, began to change American attitudes about animals. And I won't call that an animal rights movement. I will just say that he was concerned about cruelty to animals. And Congress made an attempt to pass a livestock transportation humane treatment law, you know, requiring X amount of feed and water during X amount of travel. During the 1980s, the modern roots of our concern really date back to the 1980s, when big corporate farms were becoming normal in America, and there were lots and lots of animals being raised in one spot. And animal rights activists in the 1980s began complaining about this. And that argument didn't really go that far. It was replaced by criticisms about meat tended to be based on less on animal cruelty than on things like environmental issues. And it's not really been until the last decade or so that the issue of animal rights and animal cruelty, particularly when it comes to confinement, have finally become major sticking points, major talking points for people who are critical of the American way of livestock production.
Yeah, some the image that sticks out in reading your book to me was the, was it Cincinnati or Cleveland? What is Porkopolis?
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, and they, the way they would slaughter them or bring them to the, I guess, to their end was to, what, crowd them into, describe that. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. I only included one really graphic description because I wanted people to understand, you know, what things used to be like. The easiest, back in the 1870s and so forth, they would crowd as many animals as possible into a pen, pack them in very, very tightly, so tightly they couldn't move, so that the person who was charged with killing them could walk across their backs and use sledgehammers. I'm sorry, everyone, but that's what they used. And this guy, who must have been very tired at the end of every day, would basically just smash them in the head till they were dead. But since they were packed so tightly, they wouldn't fall. And I'll just stop there because I think we've all got the point.
Yes, and it is the noon hour. Well, we're going to take a short break. Delighted to have you with us, historian and author Maureen Ogle. In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. And this is a book, fascinating read, that gives you great historical context on many of the things that we're talking about in our news. I noticed that you started this book and then you were blessed with the pink slime controversy during the writing of it, weren't you? We'll have to talk about that, won't we, Maureen?
Yes, pink slime.
Back to the colonial era, tracing the debate to the role of the meat, role of meat in a healthy diet, meatpacking processes, the use of antibiotics. I think we have a question from a caller. Join our conversation. Your questions about our country's meat production, consumption, and carnivorous culture. We're here with Maureen Ogle. 1-866-780-9100. What have you always wondered about that thing put on, that chop, that cut put on your plate in the evening? River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more of River to River in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program.
It was a dish for old Caesar, also King Henry III. But Columbus was smart, said you can't fool me, a chicken ain't nothing but a bird.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. My guest for the entire hour, writer, historian, and Iowan, Maureen Ogle. She has a new book out. It's titled In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And in this book, she goes way back to the colonial era to talk about our sense of entitlement when it comes to eating, well, I think it's almost four times the amount of meat that is average in the world. Isn't that right, Maureen?
Something like that, yeah. It's kind of a staggering amount.
I've realized I have about twice as many notes on things that I'd like you to elaborate on than we have time for, and we've got these listeners, too, who want to get in on a conversation. Let's go to this listener question. Mary Jane from Des Moines writes, I have read that the most consumed meat in the world is goat. Why don't Americans eat goat? It's not even available at the supermarket. I've wondered the same thing. Tell us, Maureen, do you know about that?
I think goat is a very cultural food. Americans ate. Goat was not a European staple. Mm-hmm. It may be now, in part because of immigration from other parts of the world, but the people who settled America did not bring a culture in which goat was valued. So, you know, you can get goat, but you've got to find the right ethnic, if I can use that word, neighborhood where right. It's sold.
And sort of the same thing can be said of lamb and sheep.
That's right.
Mutton as well. It just didn't
get taken up as the rest of the world.
The interesting thing about sheep is that one reason it didn't was because they were so susceptible to predators that sheep were actually very common in New England, but it was so much trouble to protect them that mutton just started falling off the diet.
Is it only my perception or perception widely held that beef may be the top rung when we talk about different status between types of meat? No?
Yes. I think that has certainly been true in the United States, although, again, chicken is now the king of the meats in America because it's lower in saturated fats. And, you know, that's the only reason. It's not that it tastes better. Americans perceive it to be healthier. And it tends to be cheaper in price. But if you're going to go out to dinner and have a really, you know, you want to wow somebody, you pretty much don't order a Caesar salad with chicken. You order a steak, right?
Right. And we have these things. Every large town has a steakhouse. Does every large town have a chicken house? I don't know.
No. Good point. No, I don't think so.
Rob is joining us from Dubuque. Hi, Rob. What's your question for Maureen?
Hello?
Yes, Rob, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us from Dubuque. Go ahead.
I understand that most of our beef comes from feedlots, and within the last 30 days of their life, they're injected with growth hormones and antibiotics. Could that be what's making people fat? And it is in the beef, and we're getting the beef to eat. Is that what are the implications with that? Is that causing the cancer increases we're having in our country, or... I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Robin Dubuque.
First of all, I personally would walk away from the claim that in the last 30 days they're injected with antibiotics and hormones, particularly the antibiotic thing. I don't believe that is a contributor to cancer. No, people are far more concerned about bacterial resistance or losing the resistance to that antibiotics won't work anymore. That's the issue about using antibiotics on the farm. Yes, most of our beef does come from feedlots, but I'm not an epidemiologist, but I'm pretty sure that that's not the connection with cancer. And I don't think it's what's making us allegedly obese either.
Mm-hmm. While we're in this area of modern controversies about meat, you write about the so-called pink slime uproar of 2012, which we covered here on Iowa Public Radio, certainly in many different ways. You write that it encapsulated the perplexities and conundrums of our desire to have it all. Explain what you mean by that conundrum.
Oh,
but first of all,
yeah.
Remind us what the pink slime uproar was all about.
Okay, yeah, I was fascinated. I had pretty much finished the book by the pink slime thing unfolded in the spring of 2012, and I had pretty much finished the book by then. So for once in my life, I could actually just enjoy something instead of what does this all mean? But here's the deal with pink slime in 2012.
And we should say lean, fine textured beef,
right,
in case the governor's listening.
Right. The technical term is lean, finely textured beef, but just for simplicity's sake, I'll just call it LFTB. In 2012, the USDA apparently, you know, contracted to buy meat that contained LFTB or pink slime for distribution to school lunch programs. And a blogger in Texas got wind of this and raised Cain about it. And it turned into a huge media uproar. And the poor guy who invented this process has, for all intents and purposes, lost everything since then. So here's the back. This is why I thought it was fascinating. First of all, there's just nothing wrong with the stuff that people call pink slime. It is beef, pure and simple. That's all it is.
But we have this image of beef sort of rest ends and then ammonia being squirted on it.
Yeah, well, that's not true either.
Okay.
This is why it was so interesting to me. So I'm just going to go through this chronologically to give everybody the whole background, because I do think this is a perfect example of just how messy the politics of meat are in America. Since the 1970s, meat packers and other meat processors too, but especially beef packers, started using a process to scrape all of the particles of meat off the bone. And they used this equipment that used very tiny blades to do this. And in the early 1980s, the FDA banned this process because it used blades. And there was fear that tiny slivers of bone would get into the meat. Consumer activists pressured the FDA to force meat packers to stop using this. Now, you're probably wondering, why did meat packers do this? Because meat packers do not make a profit on a beef carcass. The only way they can make profit on that carcass is through byproducts, such as selling the hides, for example. It's a pretty low profit business, and I know that probably nobody believes me when I say that. So they're trying to maximize every single piece of the carcass. It's no different than a very frugal cook would do in the kitchen, use a knife to scrape off all of the bits of usable protein, right?
Take the ham bone out and make
soup out of it the next day.
Exactly,
and you know, just really trying to get everything out of it. So the FDA banned this process, and a man named Eldon Roth, who I believe is from Nebraska, invented a process to do the same thing, but using centrifugal force, because the FDA's objection was the use of these blades. Eldon Roth is apparently a mechanical genius. He invented this process to use centrifugal force to spin bits of bone and carcass and spin all of the meat off, and also separate the actual meat from the gristle, the fat, the tendon, and all the other parts that you really don't want to eat. And he developed another process for taking these bits and compressing them into blocks. And then he would sell these to meat packers who mixed it with other beef to make hamburger. In the 1990s, after the big E. coli uproar because of the Jack in the Box episode, Eldon Roth invented a way to add a very small, nearly infinitesimal blast of ammonia to kill E. coli bacteria. And by the way, all beef contains ammonia naturally. If you eat beef, you're eating ammonia. This is the stuff that this blogger got wind of in 2012, and she had been alerted to it a few months earlier by celebrity chef Jamie Oliver. Isn't this a complicated story? Jamie Oliver, in his short-lived TV show, had a five-minute segment in which he showed his studio audience the horrors of pink slime by... He had a big plastic bucket full of ammonia, and he took a big piece of beef and dumped it in there and said, "This is pink slime," which of course was not true. There's not one single factual thing in that Jamie Oliver clip, which you can find on YouTube. And by the time this blogger got done, and by the time the media got a hold of this story, Eldon Roth teetered on bankruptcy. His business was gone. His competitors all went out of business. The other people who had, mimicked what he was doing. But the point of it was that there was absolutely nothing wrong with that. It was 100% meat. That's all it was.
And we have
heavily
several,
processed.
With several production facilities in Iowa closed down, people out of job, out of jobs in our listening area. So you're saying this is a perfect example of these conundrums. So what do you mean by that in a larger sense that this illustrates?
Well, for one thing, I would argue, this is my one big takeaway from having written this book. Only in a society like ours, a very affluent society where we have absurd amounts of food and spend virtually nothing to eat unbelievably well, only in our society would we complain about frugality, because that is really what the process was about. It was about saving every single bit in order to pass on those savings to consumers. So I just found it absolutely crazy that somehow this was not acceptable. I was also just flabbergasted by how completely inaccurate the media coverage was. I swear the media, since the publication of Omnivore's Dilemma, the media has simply bought in to every bogus argument about pretty much everything connected to meat. It's very difficult to get any kind of sanity or any kind of facts injected into the situation. And the pink slime episode was a perfect example of that.
I have to believe you're getting some reaction to this book with comments like you just made from Michael Pollan or others.
Nah, they're not even paying attention. No. I'm sure he has no idea who I am. No.
Okay.
No.
Let's go to Anthony in Fredericksburg. Hi, Anthony. You're listening to our conversation. What do you have to chip in?
I'd probably take up a little bit of issue with some of the things, but that's not what I called for. I was calling to see, with such a large consumption of meat by our nation and our large obesity rates, I was wondering if there's any correlation with any other cultures that have a similar high consumption rate of meat and also an obesity, having not, eaten so much meat for, so many thousands of years. Our body probably hasn't really kind of gotten used to that process yet. I was wondering if there was any sort of research that you found on that.
Boy, that's a good question. There are so few countries that eat as much meat as we do that would actually be difficult to make a comparison. But let me just add to the context, and I'm not dismissing your question at all because it's a good one. The obesity epidemic is, again, an example of, misrepresentation of situations. As near as I can tell, we don't really have an obesity epidemic. That's my take on what I've read. But I do not think that our high meat consumption has anything to do with this alleged obesity epidemic, if only because, man, we Americans have been packing it away since about 1607 when, you know, those first settlers got to Jamestown. And the alleged obesity epidemic is a product of the last 20 years. So I'm pretty sure there's not a correlation. But, you know, it's a good, I think the previous caller also alluded to that. I think that there are, I suspect that in the public's mind, there probably is a correlation. But no, it would be my answer. No.
Remaining minutes, 10 minutes or so, with Maureen Ogle in Meat We Trust, her latest book, as she spent 7 years researching this book, over 200 years of government documents, trade magazines, newspapers, personal accounts that she delved into. You write, Maureen, in your book, "Ours is not just the largest, but also the most successful meat-making apparatus in the world, so efficient that until recently the entire infrastructure was like air, invisible, out of sight, out of mind." I bring that up because it's such a huge part of our culture, our economy, and everything. And I am here, as you are, here in Iowa. We don't see it.
That's right.
Why is it invisible?
Again, I think that's because of the efficiency. Now, let me just put that in a larger context, which, again, why shouldn't we rile up your audience once again? One of the arguments against meat in America, against the meat production system, both the livestock production and the meat processing, is that somehow this is a plot on the part of big corporations to force feed us meat, that, you know, that we're constantly being sort of subliminally persuaded to eat more meat than we really want. I'm not buying it. What my research, and again, as you've pointed out a couple of times, it's not like it took me 2 minutes to write this book. My research indicates that the system that we have has been built over the past 150 or so years to satisfy demand. The driving factor here consistently and always has been demand, demand, demand. And we've also built a system that all these efficiencies just kept being built into it, moving, for example, the packing industry out of Chicago and out into rural areas, because you could eliminate a lot of transportation costs because that's where the livestock were. All of these things were designed and built and streamlined in order to satisfy an insatiable demand on the part of the American public. I mean, we want the meat. We don't want to think too hard about where it comes from. We don't want to live with it. I don't know about anybody else, but I don't really want cattle wandering down the streets here in Ames if I can help it. So, yes, it's out of sight and out of mind because that is where we want it. The generations who preceded us and us today, we are the ones who built this system.
Mm-hmm. Looking toward the future, after combing through the last 200 plus years with your history of meat in America, what can the meat industry do better? What do you expect in the future? Because you seem to be saying, we ask for it, we get it. That's how responsive the meat industry is.
I agree. And for example, yesterday on the front page of the Des Moines Register, there was an article about Smithfield announcing that it's asking its contractors to phase out gestation stalls, and it's doing this in response to consumer demand. People say to me, you know, this system is horrible, it's awful, we've just got to get rid of it. And my response to that is, if you want to change the system, what we have to do first is change the demand. We eat roughly 225 pounds of meat a year per capita, and that means some people are eating a whole lot more, because I only eat 25 pounds a year, and a lot of people are vegetarian. So if you want to change the existing livestock and meat processing infrastructure, it's a response to demand. We're just going to have a different meat culture. And we may be getting it by default. For example, everyone that I have talked to who has a reason to know is quite confident, and I'm talking about livestock producers, that antibiotics are going to be banned and very soon. And that will force a change in the prices of meat. It will force a change in the way meat is produced. And it will probably alter demand. So I'm guessing that given another, I don't know how many years, but eventually we may not need this great big infrastructure we have.
Mm. You've mentioned a couple times that you were a meat eater only in the last decade or so.
Yeah, when I was living back in Iowa City, back in the 70s, because I'm real old, people, I don't remember reading Diet for a Small Planet, but somebody back then, in between, you know, smoking pot, we must have all talked about it. And I stopped eating meat for political reasons. And then as I got poorer, as I got older, it was, you know, I just couldn't afford to eat it. But in, I think it was about 2000, I decided, I just really wasn't feeling great. And I realized I needed more protein. So now I do eat meat. But again, I eat 25 pounds a year, and on average per capita, Americans eat 225. So I'm way off the bell curve as far as meat eating goes.
So let me picture, have you describe your favorite cut of meat if I can put it on a plate in front of you here over the noon hour?
Frankly, if I could really have anything I'd want, what I'd really want is a piece of grilled fish, because my husband, he hates fish, and so I never cook it at home. But, you know, I can't say that meat is a... I have
nothing
to say,
of the four-legged variety.
You know, we have developed kind of a fondness for pork because we can buy really, really good Iowa pork that's, you know, locally sustainably produced and so on and so forth. And we eat so little of it that I can, you know, we can afford to pay extra for it. I don't, frankly, if you were going to give me a meal that I really wanted, it probably wouldn't have any meat in it.
Mm. Okay. Today, you mentioned pork. Today, what is it? Over a quarter of all the nation's hogs are raised right here in Iowa, in addition to the cattle and the millions of turkeys that are raised here in Iowa. Have you ever killed an animal to eat?
I have not. My husband has. This was back in the... I didn't know him then, but somewhere down in southern Iowa, he went to some hippie's farm and they slaughtered a steer, and he said it was the hardest work. He said it took them days. He said, I had no idea it was so much work. No, I haven't done it. No.
Any idea? Because we had formerly worked at Iowa Public Radio, but also a student at the University of Iowa, grad student for his project. He had never killed an animal to eat. So this was his project. He bought and raised a piglet until it was full grown. Nick Burgess is his name. He bought a piglet, raised it over months, and then he killed it himself. Because he thought that if he eats meat, he should have the courage to do the killing as well.
Well, that is, he's not the only person making that argument. A guy published a book recently about that. You know, here's one thing that I did think about meat. About 6 months into the book, when I was doing the research, I thought, you know, if you really want to eat meat, you can't think about it. And I never stopped to think about that before. But I think, honestly, we just have to not think about it. So, you know what I mean?
And there we go back to the invisibility, don't we?
Yeah.
Because we're getting what we want. We don't want to know it comes from
animals.
That's
right. That's exactly right. So, and, you know, Peter Singer and other people have made the argument that the more you distance yourself, the more willing you are to ignore the consequences of eating another living being. And there's definitely something to be said for that, because if you start thinking about it, you lose your appetite pretty quickly. So, yeah. And I don't mean because it's gory. I just mean that, you know, when you really stop and think, as Paul McCartney's wife, Linda Eastman, used to say, don't eat anything with eyes. You know, if you think about it that way, I mean, it becomes harder to eat meat. It does.
Right. And our words reflect the fact that we want this distance. We don't eat cows. We eat beef.
That's right.
We don't
eat
pigs. We eat pork.
And we don't slaughter them. They are harvested. That's my favorite piece of terminology. They're harvested.
Oh, it's been wonderful to talk with you. I wish we had more time, but I hope people will dig into your book because it is really an eye-opener. Maureen Ogle, historian and author and inhabitant of Iowa for your whole life.
My whole life. I've lived here 60 years, people. I like living here.
We are glad to have you, and glad to have you share the effort of 7 years of research in Meat We Trust, an unexpected history of carnivore America, and it's been published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much, Maureen.
Thank you, Ben.
And that winds up our program for today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. And if you caught only part of the hour and want to listen to the entire hour, or you want to listen again, remember, we always have podcasts available after each broadcast. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River, available simply by going to iowapublicradio.org.
and search for River to River. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Our email address, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Pork chops. My girl tastes like pork chops. My girl tastes like pork chops. When I kiss her, I wonder what she had for dinner.